Why isn't there a family version? A family version. A family version.
Hello. Hello. And welcome to another episode of the MAB podcast. My name's Matt Brown, and together with the Children's Laureate Wales, Eloise Williams, I'm trying to crowdfund a new retelling of the Mabinogion for young people. We've called it the MAB, and this is the podcast for it. The MAB podcast. Make sense? Good. Okay. Let's move on. Today on the podcast, we welcome one of the MAB authors, P.G. Bell. PG, aka Peter, is the best-selling author of the Train to Impossible Places series and is going to be writing one of the MAB stories when we achieve 100% funding. If you'd like to support the MAB, then go to unbound.com/books/the-MAB. Details are in the description to this very podcast. And, extra good news, if you become a supporter in December 2020, that's the month that this podcast is being recorded in, or if you upgrade your current support to a new level, then you'll be in with a chance of winning a free school visit to a school of your choice from Eloise or me. Again, the details for that are in the description to this podcast. Now, before we set sail on the good ship Peter Bell, then I do want to apologise for the quality of my microphone when I chatted to Peter. You'll hear it as soon as I speak. I've got a strange Dalek-y quality to my voice. I have no idea why that happened. Peter's mic sounds lovely on it, but mine sounds all weird. So anyway, rest assured, a full investigation is underway here at MAB Towers, and heads will almost certainly roll. So, my microphone issues aside, I hope you enjoy the podcast. Pete is always lovely to chat to about books and writing and stuff like that, and we had a really lovely chat about lots of things connected to the Mabinogion, including why the Mabinogion is like the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But first things first, I wanted to know when Peter first read the Mabinogion.
I don't think there was one defining moment, really. It's come to me in dribs and drabs over the years through retellings and little bits of individual stories and things. The first time that I sat down and read it all through as a complete collection was only within the last year. So very recently, really.
What was it that sort of like prompted you to sit down and read the whole thing?
It's one of those books that's just been on my reading list for donkey's years. I mean, going back to my sort of late teens, I would say. And I've been getting around to it and getting around to it. And I think it was really just going through fantasy stories with my son at bedtime and coming up with bedtime stories. And yeah, he'd liked lots of traditional bits of folk tales and legends and things like that, and fairy stories. And I thought, well, it'd be good if I could sit down with him and I'd be reading it for me and he would also be benefiting. But if we could read the Mabinogion together in some form, that would be quite nice. And my parents dug out a reasonably modern-ish, like within the last 20 years, retelling of, I think it's the second branch of the Mabinogion that had this big format with illustrations. And we went through that. But as far as I could tell, it was just a standalone volume. There was nothing else to go with it. There was none of the rest of the Mabinogion. And so I started casting around, which is, I think, is where you and I crossed paths on this. Because I put out a call on Twitter asking if anybody had a good collection, you know, all together. Not necessarily for sort of family consumption, but just a nice version. And I thought, well, I can read it through and I can retell it if I have to. I was quite surprised that there wasn't a family-friendly version of everything in one place, really.
Yeah, it seems strange, that, doesn't it? And it's the difference in readability of the various translations is quite marked, I think. I've now got quite a few Mabinogions around.
You've become a collector.
Yeah. And the one that I like the most, I think, is the Shona Davis version.
Ah, that's the one that I ended up with. It's very much an academic sort of book. It's very comprehensive. I love all the footnotes and references and things like that. It is very educational, but not the sort of thing you can sit down, you know, with an 8-year-old and say, right,
no,
let's plow into this.
Here we go.
Two bookmarks, one for the appendices and one for the actual story.
That's what I've got. Like you, I wanted one that I could read to my son, and that was everything.
It does make sense if it exists as a volume.
Yeah.
You know, for everything else, you know, in poetry and in academic texts and, you know, going back hundreds and hundreds of years, why isn't there a family version?
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder whether it's because there's some things that are not child-friendly, but that seems so easy to just exorcise for a kid, you know what I mean, a retelling for young people. It seems like such an obvious edit to be able to make.
It shouldn't be too hard to work your way around. If you think of, you know, a lot of the Arthurian legends and the Greek myths and legends, there's loads of stuff in there that's not really suitable for kids. And yet the number of collections of, you know, Greek and Roman mythology and Norse myth that's available for like the under 10s, there's loads of it. So I think it shouldn't be any great task to do the same thing for the Mabinogion.
And also I've been rereading some Greek myths recently and thinking a lot about how they are so happily truncated and repackaged as standalone stories. The one that sort of immediately springs to mind is the story of Icarus, which is obviously probably every 10-year-old will be able to tell you that Icarus, you know, was the kid who flew too close to the sun. But then you sort of like, if you pull out a little bit, you realise that Icarus's dad is sort of instrumental in the Minotaur story. It was the guy who created the labyrinth. And if you pull out again, you find out that he was actually instrumental in creating the Minotaur as well. You know?
Yeah.
And so that these stories are brilliant standalone stories, but actually they are part of the whole sort of like the grand sweeping epic retelling of Greek myths.
The Marvel Cinematic Universe of its time.
Yeah, it is a bit. So now that you've sort of read the stories, all 11 stories, do you have a favourite few? Do you have some that you that really sort of like resonated with you?
Yes. I mean, the one that really stands out for me is the story of Peredur, which is, you know, he's basically a peasant boy, but he's of noble stock and his family has been banished after their side lost a great battle. And he's grown up in complete poverty in a shack in the woods and knows nothing about being a knight, but decides that he wants to be one. And so, you know, his mum agrees to send him off to seek his fortune in the world and dresses him up with pots and pans out of the kitchen drawer and gets an old donkey because she can't afford a horse and just sends him out to chance his luck.
Yeah.
And everybody he meets, he fights because he thinks this is what a knight has to do. And everyone he fights, he beats because it turns out he's actually the best knight in the country.
Yeah.
with no training, no background, no clue about what he's doing at all. And he basically wanders up and down the length and breadth of Britain for a few months, battering the living daylights out of everyone he comes across.
Just picking fights.
That's it. And he goes to Arthur's court because he wants to join the Knights of the Round Table. And when he gets there, Arthur's out questing. And it's just the knights looking after the place. So he fights all of them and beats them, particularly Kai, who who comes off... who always seems to get the short end of the stick in every story. I think Kai must be one of my favourite recurring characters.
Really?
He's never a main character in anything. He's always sort of secondary or tertiary character.
Yeah.
And you get the impression that nobody takes Kai half as seriously as he takes himself.
No, he's very rude to Peredur, though, isn't he?
He is very rude to everyone, but I think he feels that the dignity and standing of Arthur's court sort of rest largely on his shoulders. And he's always being sort of brought up short. And I think in one story, Arthur makes a joke at his expense that incenses him so much that he storms off and never returns, and that's literally the last anyone ever sees of Kai.
It's brilliant, that, isn't it? And I like that story as well, because it's got, I mean, when I first read it, it was actually one of my least favourite stories in the Mabinogion, but I think because it is so, you can really get a sense of it being a story that was told orally from the way it's certainly presented in Shona Davis's version. Because it goes on and on and on.
There's a lot of repetition.
Yes.
I come to a field, I meet a knight.
Yeah.
I fight the knight and I win. I go to a forest, I find another knight.
But it's, what is the interesting things about it is that it's sort of, there's a bit of a grail quest in that story, and there's a bit of, there's the Fisher King makes an appearance in that story.
Yes, yeah, there's all sorts of odd little bits and pieces that sort of crop up here and there just to break up the flow of the whole thing, and you know, he meets a queen and marries and settles down and then goes off questing again. It's all sorts of, it just takes some, I think it's in many respects one of the most straightforward of the stories,
right? Yeah,
because it has a set formula that it just keeps repeating all the way through, but then in between these sections of repeating formula you'll have something slightly off center and weird, just to sort of catch you off guard. I quite like that.
Yeah. Thematically, it feels like the Mabinogion is the constant tension between the, for want of a better word, the real world and the other world, and the way that the two interact with each other. I suppose in the same way, like in Greek myths, there is that sense of the natural and the supernatural, isn't there?
That's true. Although they seem much closer, I think, in the Mabinogion. And there isn't even always a hard and fast border between the two.
You
can just walk around the wrong tree, or you know, around the wrong rock somewhere, and suddenly
they're there.
The two have interlinked.
The other world can just pop up at any time, any place, anywhere.
And when it does, it's always going to be weird. it's going to just like hoover up everyone in Powys. They're going to vanish for years on end.
Yes.
Without explanation.
That story, which is, that's the third branch you're talking about, right? That one. I love that story so much. But again, it's funny, isn't it? They go to the place, the mountain, where Poeth had first encountered Rhiannon in the first branch, where he's told something like, you will see something wonderful, or a great terror will befall you. You know what I mean? It's like, it's going to be great or it's going to be awful.
Yeah.
And in the first branch, it's great because he sees Rhiannon. But in the third branch, it's awful because when they come down from the mountain, everybody has completely vanished. I just thought that was really excellent.
And there are still mountains like that, you know, or tales attached to mountains in North Wales and South Wales as well, I think, at the moment, aren't there? Even today they say if you go up this mountain and stay overnight, you will either go mad or you'll come down a great poet.
Right, okay, yeah.
Yeah, one or the other.
Yes, one thing or the other.
Yeah, there's no middle ground.
Yeah, like that.
Something big will happen to you one way or the other, but the other world will bless you with artistic genius or madness.
Great big thanks to Peter Bell for chatting to me, sitting down and spending time chewing the mab fat. That doesn't sound very nice. Anyway, don't forget to support the mab by going to unbound.com/books/the-mab. Thank you so much for listening, for supporting, and please, please, please spread the word about the Mab. Mab spread.